Allow me to introduce myself. I'm Dirk Mosik, currently at Kearney State College, formerly of Miskatonic University. I was terminated, of course, when they found me trying to rip off their copy of the Necronomicon, although I did get something, as you see. The subject and the topic of our panel is rather strange, I think. What if Lovecraft had lived through the 60s? I did not choose that topic, but we will try to address ourselves at least in part to that subject. Allow me to introduce to you the other members of the panel, starting at my right with Mr. J. Vernon Shea, who had the honor and the distinction of having actually corresponded with Lovecraft. Mr. Shea has published several anthologies. He's a writer. He has published a number of stories. I remember the growing library of Professor Pitts, which gives any book collector nightmares. He has had stories published in fantasy and science fiction and in other magazines. To my immediate right is Professor Donald Burleson, also of Miskatonic University, who is a mathematician and who will be sharing with us some of his insights into the meaning of some quasi-mathematical and scientific concepts in the fiction of Lovecraft. To my immediate left is Mr. S.T. Joshi, strangely enough another member of Miskatonic University. We have most of the esoteric faculty. Mr. Joshi is perhaps one of the brightest stars in the area of Lovecraft criticism and research today. He has compiled a tremendous amount of research. He's right now finishing a comprehensive bibliography of H.P. Lovecraft to be published by Kent State University Press. The thing will have something like 500 pages. In addition, he has written a critique of every Lovecraft story, which remains unpublished. He has edited a collection of Lovecraft criticism, and he's engaged in a dozen other projects. Perhaps the most important of which, though, is the checking of the accuracy of the Lovecraft text. He has been able to compare word by word manuscripts at the John Hay Library with the printed text, finding literally thousands of errors in the Arkham House versions, whole paragraphs missing, etc., etc. And at my extreme left is the one person on this panel who obviously needs no introduction, Dr. Henry Armitage, also of Miskatonic University, who sometimes writes under the pen name of Fritz Leiber, not ever, though, under the pen name of Fritz Leiber. And who will be the first in addressing this distinguished audience today, since he will probably have to depart early in order to attend the banquet. Professor Armitage.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Morgan, or I think he was the youngest of the group that met the Dunwich Horror on Sentinel Hill, but yes, I have to get away very shortly, and so I should tell you that I had, like Mr. Vernon Shea, I had the great privilege of exchanging a number of letters with Lovecraft during the last 3 or 4 months of his life. I at one time had thought back to that period as being longer, and that we had corresponded for 6 months about, but it just seemed that. It seemed that way because so much did happen. My wife wrote to Lovecraft originally, care of not Weird Tales, but Street and Smith, because I think The Shadow Out of Time had just been published, and wanting to know where people could get a hold of copies of his earlier stories. And so he wrote her a very courteous letter in reply, and then I got up my nerve to correspond with him. And the first letter from Lovecraft to my wife came on the 9th of, was dated the 9th of November by Lovecraft. And so our big correspondence really all took place in November, December, and the first part of January in 1937. And it amazes me that it covered such a short period, because so many things happened to me in that time. We exchanged letters about his writing, and he read my first Fafford Mauser story that wasn't published, Adept's Gambit, that wasn't published until 1937, and very, very, very helpfully criticized it in some detail, but being very careful in his criticism, he always found something good to say about anyone's story. That's my experience of him. He was a very thoughtful, a critic who was very thoughtful of the authors he was criticizing. And if he had lived on to the 1960s, why, all I can say in the first place is that he would have had a much greater influence on my own writing, I think. I would have continued to correspond to him and look up to him as a sort of master, both in the weird tale, the tale of supernatural horror, and in general as a master in the arts of scholarship and living in general. I mean, I know that at the time my writing became more honest and more careful. I began to write like so many people did that met him. I began to write a Lovecraftian type story that I finally completed in the 1970s, the Terror from the Depths, because at the time when he died, I laid it aside because I really wasn't up to handling it without more help from him, probably at that time, some suggestions from him. And so, and it also my reaction to his death was that, you know, not to try to write imitatively, certainly in any way. But I think if he had lived on into the 1960s, he would have reached recognition both as a writer of supernatural horror and of science fiction, because his novel The Shadow Out of Time would have been published as it was in the Viking Portable Novels of Science, edited by Donald Wolheim. And generally speaking, there wouldn't have been any opposition between science fiction and supernatural horror stories as developed in the 50s and 60s when his stories were being reprinted by Arkham House. I don't think there would have been any sort of opposition. I think Lovecraft himself would have maintained in general a sort of scientific skepticism during that period. He would have been a skeptic about phenomena like such as flying saucers. I remember I wrote him with great enthusiasm about the books of Charles Fort, and he wrote back a long letter in which he explained that he thought Fort was a great source book for people who wrote weird fiction, but that he didn't take Fort's refutations of scientific discovery very seriously. He said that scientists had to be agreed in a much more detailed way. They couldn't accept even very well authenticated reports of strange flying objects and such things unless they were confirmed by subsequent reports, and unless he explained to me how science deals with phenomena that can be repeated, either as experiments that can be done by other persons, or observations that can be made by other persons if they follow the directions that led to the first observation. And so he really did a great deal to make me more of a scientific skeptic in my own outlook. That was the result of his outlooks on in influencing mine. And I was thinking of that yesterday when I read the end of the Dunwich Horror, where there is a very homely sort of indication of Lovecraft's feelings about science. It's where Dr. Armitage and the other two, Professors Rice and Morgan, I think they were, they're going up Sentinel Hill, and they leave their pocket telescope with the Dunwich farmers through which they later see the face of Yog-Sothoth's son. And there's a great deal about explaining how difficult it is to even adjust for an ordinary individual, a layman who isn't familiar with telescopes, to adjust even a simple pocket telescope. And there's details about how Armitage and Rice and Morgan remembered enough of this, so they gave detailed instructions to the farmers on how to focus the telescope and how to make use of it. Lovecraft did have this sort of feeling for the realities of science, and I think it was always with him, and on the whole never left him. That's one of my reactions there. I do think that in the end of supernatural horror and literature, Lovecraft makes some speculations about the future, and he says that one thing is certain, that scientific discovery, intra-atomic physics and long-distance astronomy, I mean out to the galaxies and beyond, would continue to stimulate the imagination of fantasy writers. And of course that was the case, and I think Lovecraft himself would have found great stimulation in modern-day astronomy. Can you imagine how much he would have been fascinated by black holes and the theories of the expanding universe and the theories that led to the modern concept that all suns of a certain type are probably accompanied by planets, and that planets aren't the rare things that that Moulton and thought they were back in the days when Lovecraft was writing science fiction. And so I think that would have kept his interests alive. I think as far as science fiction is concerned, he would have appreciated the development of more literary writers, even in the magazines, and undoubtedly the magazine Unknown Worlds would have approved many of the stories in that, and would have been led to see that the influence of Weird Tales and of the fantasy magazines was spreading and into science fiction and stimulating them. So I think some of the bitter oppositions between Lovecraftian writers and science fiction writers would probably never have developed at all in that cosmos. Well, I think that unless there's some questions you want to ask as to something I could provide for this discussion, I think that ends my contribution.
Well, since you're planning to leave early, why don't we allow some member of the audience to ask you a question before you disappear?
Yes.
Yes, where did your Lovecraftian story publication?
Oh, it was The Disciples of Cthulhu, edited by Paul Berglund.
Did them reappear then?
It was Daw Publications. No, it's going to be in a volume called Heroes and Horrors, that a collection of my stories that Whispers Press is bringing out this fall.
Thank you, Professor Armitage.
Thank you.
Mr. Joshi?
Needless to say, I did not have the privilege of corresponding with Lovecraft since I was born 21 years after his death. So I can only, I cannot remark on Lovecraft's own character as much as how I think the times and the future would have influenced him. Certainly the man affects the age, but I think more the age affects the man. And I wish to address myself to certain ideas on political and economic developments after Lovecraft's death, and to hypothesize on what Lovecraft would have made of them. The question is very complex because Lovecraft's political and economic views perhaps are not very well understood. First of all, it is important to understand that Lovecraft was really very far-sighted in many of his speculations, and that simply because he was entranced by the 18th century or by ancient Rome, it is not to be concluded that he had no awareness of his own time. He certainly did. As early as 1921, he predicted that another world war would be necessary to what he called to straighten out the situation after World War I, and he realized that the Treaty of Versailles had put a great burden upon Germany, and that Germany would not stand for this very much longer. True enough, it came true, although he did not live to see it. In the 30s, Lovecraft began increasingly to be involved in economic speculation. He advocated Roosevelt's New Deal. In fact, he even believed that the New Deal was not liberal enough in its attempted reforms. He advocated unemployment insurance before it was adopted. He advocated old age pensions. He realized the effects of technological advance and mechanization, not only culturally but economically. He realized that there are now fewer and fewer people who are capable of or who are necessary to perform the operations of a society due to mechanization. And he realized that some sort of economic reform would be necessary. The laissez-faire capitalism that America has and even continues to adopt, modified, could not be maintained without havoc, literally. In fact, he wrote a very important essay. It is unpublished. It is called Some Repetitions on the Times. It was written about 3 weeks after the inauguration of Roosevelt in 1933. This essay outlines basically his political and economic motives. Politically, he was what we might term a fascist, but when I mention this, you must not connect it with either the Mussolini fascism or the Hitlerian fascism. What Lovecraft envisioned was, plain and simple, an aristocracy of intellect. He felt that democracy and the methods used by the democratic process to elect its officials could not stand up to the requirements of government, simply because government had become incredibly complex, and it required an extreme knowledge of politics, economics, foreign policy, and other matters for logical decisions to be made. The democratic process is almost a sort of accidental method of electing officials, because the voters are simply influenced by demagogues and they like you know, whatever appeals to them on a subjective emotional level, without regarding so much the actual issues involved. You know, we all enjoy Jimmy Carter's smile, or at least some of us do, but you know, what is he actually thinking, or does he think? This is the matter, and Lovecraft realized that something would have to be done. Of course, it has not been to date. I say all this because I'm sure that many believe that Lovecraft was some sort of right-wing reactionary who advocated, you know, hereditary aristocracy and you know, extreme right-wing control and oligarchy. He was, as I say, he advocated simply an aristocracy of intellect, which would put actual officials who knew what was going on into positions of power. Economically, on the other hand, he developed into a socialist. That is to say, he realized that the division of wealth was necessary if all of us are to maintain a decent existence. But that division of wealth does not necessarily entail a division of power, political power. His political and economic views are therefore quite distinct and should be considered rather separately. He advocated socialism so that we would not have a few millionaires and millions of unemployed, but on the contrary, we would have a general leveling out. Although, again, this leveling out would not be the extreme leveling that was postulated by communism, which he couldn't stand, because but it would be a leveling out according to one's own value, according to one's own additions to society. Now, if we try to understand or look at what happened after Lovecraft's death, we might, based on these concepts that I've outlined, attempt to speculate, although I think it's a rather idle speculation, attempt to speculate on what he would have thought of certain political movements and events that occurred in particularly the United States after his death. Firstly, there's the incident of Joe McCarthy in the 50s. I don't need to explain what and how Joe McCarthy went about doing what he did. It's fairly well known. But I think that I may say that Lovecraft might have approved in certain regards of Joe McCarthy, at least approved of his ideas or ideals. He wished to eliminate communism. Lovecraft too wished to eliminate communism because he did not think that communism could produce a way of life that could produce a culture, a civilization. He saw that communism in his own era had destroyed culture, and that any culture that was arising out of communist countries was arising almost in spite of the political actions of that country. Therefore, I think he would have applauded Joe McCarthy's attempt to stop communism in the United States, but, and this is the important part, he would not have enjoyed or approved of the means used by McCarthy. He would have thought that McCarthy was an extremist, and he would have felt that the way he went about things was all wrong, and it was not a rational means of eliminating communism, but an emotional one and a subjective one, which Lovecraft would have despised. It is really quite similar to Lovecraft's hedging admiration of Hitler, which is again misunderstood. We have been bred to consider Hitler as the paramount maniac and lunatic, and perhaps he was. But Lovecraft saw that, in spite of this, there were some ideals in Hitler's policies which might be conceivably worth carrying out. But again, he objected strongly to Hitler's way of carrying those ideals out. And so again, I think that the McCarthy era would have found him ambivalent. Similarly, the controversy about Vietnam. It was again an attempt to halt the spread of communism in Southeast Asia, an attempt which has failed miserably. I think he would have approved of the attempt to stop the Viet Cong, but again the means were wrong or badly done. Indeed, in Vietnam is one of the most incompetently managed wars in the history of American warfare, and he would have felt that this was not the way to carry out these ends. So, to conclude, I don't have really very much more to say. To conclude, I think we should regard Lovecraft as really very far-sighted, very aware of what was going on, and very able to hypothesize and to postulate about the future developments of certain incidents and events that were occurring in his time. His prediction that mechanization would become extremely broadened and in the future decades is really very very perspicacious, because the signs and the earmarks were not very very prevalent in Lovecraft's own era, and it shows really a great awareness of the contemporary scene to deduce these factors. So we should regard Lovecraft as both left-wing and right-wing at the same time. And this need not be particularly contradictory, because he was right-wing in the sense that he advocated limitations of power, but he was left-wing in advocating the arbitrary and, or rather, the artificial spreading of wealth. And I really see him as a very important political and economic thinker. And he was not the emotional, the rabid racist, as he has been called, which many have liked to think he was. I think he was a very brilliant thinker, as well as a brilliant fiction writer. And I think that his philosophical thought needs a great deal of understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Joshi. On approaching the subject of our panel, One could have chosen to approach it in terms of discussing what Lovecraft the man would have done or experienced in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Or, on the other hand, one could focus on Lovecraft the writer. And I'm going to try to do the latter, to speculate on what he would have written if he would have continued to write. Would he have become a commercial writer, as De Camp insists he should have, because it was foolish for him not to? Or would he have produced perhaps the kind of fiction that, for example, Brian Lumley came up with? Or would his output of it would have been perhaps totally different? As some of you may know, I'm currently working on a book, a critical study of the Lovecraft oeuvre for Twain Publishers, for the Twain United States Authors Series. And the first chapter in the book actually deals with the essentials of Lovecraft as a writer.